Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the crushing Brexit defeat inflicted on the British Prime Minister Theresa May today in a vote of 432-202, which was followed by a call by the Labour opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn for a no-confidence vote scheduled for Wednesday. Rob Ford, a professor of political science at the University of Manchester and author of Revolt on the Right, joins us to discuss the deepening dysfunction of British politics already paralysed by the Brexit vote 2.5 years ago, which has been followed by entangled negotiations with the EU over a bitter divorce more and more Britons now appear to regret. We'll examine the likelihood that Corbyn's no-confidence vote will not bring down May's government, and what could be agreed to before the March 29 deadline for the UK to crash out of the EU. Since the original Brexit ballot offered a simple choice between leave and remain, we will assess what kind of do-over referendum could emerge, and more importantly, what choices would a new referendum ballot offer that could satisfy those who see Brexit as an epic mistake engineered by shady characters financed by Russian money, and those alienated from the political ruling class who the people were able to go around with the original Brexit vote. Then we'll get an assessment of today's confirmation hearing of William Barr to be the next Attorney General and speak with Bill Yeomans, who served 26 years in the Department of Justice in a series of management positions, including Acting Assistant Attorney General. We will discuss the possibility that the 19-page unsolicited memo Barr wrote arguing the Mueller investigation was, quote, fatally misconceived, was an audition, not unlike how Acting Attorney General Whitaker's criticism of Mueller on TV got Trump's attention, which is in stark contrast to today's assurances by Barr that he would let Mueller finish his report and not be bullied by Trump into suppressing it. Then finally, with the Trump administration signaling that it might recognize Venezuela's National Assembly President Juan Guaido as the country's legitimate head of state instead of President Maduro, who was sworn in for a second term last week, we'll examine whether that will backfire with Virginia Lopez, a Caracas-based journalist who covered Venezuela for The Guardian and Al Jazeera English. She joins us to discuss a country unraveling with growing defections from the military as hyperinflation and shortages of food and medicine are beginning to make life unbearable for the average Venezuelan. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now from the UK is Rob Ford, who's a professor of political science at the University of Manchester, whose research focuses on areas of public opinion, electoral choice, and party politics. He's the author of Revolt on the Right, which examines the rise of the UK Independence Party, who were the proponents of Brexit. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rob Ford.
Hello.
So, Rob, the Parliament took a pretty late vote on Theresa May's Brexit deal with the European Union, and it went down with a crushing defeat. I think it's a record of 432-202, and already the Labour opposition leader, Jeremy Corbyn, has called for a vote of no confidence, which I believe is scheduled for tomorrow, Wednesday. So a pretty tumultuous day in British politics.
Yes, I mean, it's been an unstable couple of years, but the roller coaster has really headed off down the steepest part of its sort of crazy ride today. We're in for a very, very turbulent few days from here on in. It is the largest defeat a government has ever suffered on a vote in the era of modern party politics. But at this stage, nobody as yet knows what's going to happen next. The likelihood is that May will survive the confidence motion that's due tomorrow at 7 p.m., which can look a bit paradoxical given that she's just gone down to a 200-vote defeat. But the reason is that the people who are unwilling to vote for her Brexit deal are also unwilling to end her government and trigger a general election, because the one thing they dislike more than her Brexit deal is the prospect of the opposition, led by Jeremy Corbyn, taking over and basically taking the process out of their hands completely.
Well, it's understandable that they don't want to vote themselves out of power. But there are, I believe, more and more calls for what seems to be a simple and logical solution, given the, what, couple of years of paralysis since the Brexit vote, which would be a do-over.
Well, it has a certain simple and logical appeal, particularly given the sort of magnetic force that the idea of this popular mandate, this popular will in the first referendum has. It seems like a good way to cut the Gordian knot, but it's actually more difficult in practice because there are a number of pretty substantial factions in Parliament that don't regard this as a good idea, because they fear it'll produce an outcome that they like even less. And there's also rather a number of complications with it, including the fact that you'll need to delay Britain's exit in order to organise the vote. You'd need to get the government's cooperation to actually have the referendum, and you'd need to decide what question to ask the public on that referendum ballot paper, which could be hugely consequential, because various bits of polling that have been done here in the past 6 months suggest that the answer you'll get in a second referendum will depend quite strongly on the exact form of question that you ask. So it's like everything with this very tangled Brexit process. It looks simple at first glance, but when you look a bit more closely, it's much more difficult and complicated than that.
Well, on one side of the ballot, the Remain side, which would be, you'd go back to the original vote, which was the choice between Leave and Remain. So the Remain side is pretty stable and logical. On the other side of the ballot, couldn't you just put up the latest deal that Theresa May has come up with the EU? I mean, isn't that the choice that the British people are faced with now?
Well, it's not even a given that you get the Remain side on the ballot paper. The Prime Minister's preference, especially given the scale of the defeat she's had today, would probably be to put her deal versus leaving with no deal to the public. That is probably a non-starter, because we'd need the EU to extend the process to enable the referendum to happen, and they're going to insist that Remain be offered to the people as an option. But then what's the other option? The people who want us to leave with no deal at all are not going to be willing to vote for a referendum question that excludes that option. But on the other hand, everybody else in Parliament that wants to avoid a no deal because they regard it as catastrophically disruptive will want no deal excluded as a question. And also, do you put this particular deal to the public, or do you offer this deal along with other alternatives? These are the kind of discussions that have been had. And the truth is that there's no clear consensus in Parliament on the matter of what question to ask, just as there's also no clear consensus in Parliament on the question of whether to have another referendum at all, because a number of politicians are very concerned that a second referendum would further deepen the very deep and emotional divides in the public that we already have, and do more harm than good. It might return a very similar narrow verdict, but everyone's just a great deal angrier, so that there are quite a number of parliamentarians who are in favour of it in theory as a solution, as in they would be willing to have a second referendum at some point, but they think to have a second one now, so soon after the first one, is a bad idea that should only be entertained if there are no other options left on the table. So there's also this matter of priority. You know, there's a lot of MPs who would back a second referendum as a last resort to avoid a no deal, but won't back it as a first resort. So again, we get back to this problem of logjams.
And again, I'm speaking with Rob Ford, who's in the United Kingdom, where he's a professor of political science at the University of Manchester, and his research focuses on area of public opinion, electoral choice and party politics. And he's the author of Revolt on the Right, which examines the rise of the UK Independence Party, which championed the Brexit vote. So, but the one thing that is certain here, in amidst the uncertainty which you've laid out, Rob, is that at the end of March, like it or not, the UK crashes out of the EU. That's the deadline, isn't it? So that seems to be the one piece of certainty. And except for a few diehard Brexiteers, I understand that most people in the UK recognise that that would be a catastrophe.
Yes, I mean, if nothing changes, if Parliament is unable to agree on anything else, then that's the default. Yes, that's written into law, written into the EU treaty law, written into British domestic law, that March 29th, 2019, we go out. But unless anything changes, as things stand, we go out without any deal in place with the EU. And there is a pretty broad consensus across all sections of expert opinion, business opinion, legal opinion, that the costs of that would be very significant, that there would be a lot of disruption from that. There is not actually, though, however, consensus in the public about the level of disruption that would involve, because an awful lot of Leave voters encouraged, it has to be said, by many Leave-supporting politicians, take the view that the disruption would be fairly minimal and that efforts to claim that this would be very bad news for the country and cause a lot of damage amount to yet another round of what they're fond of calling over here Project Fear, which is the term that they use for allegedly misleading efforts by the government to scare people into options that they don't like by presenting them with inflated risks of disruption. And that reflects a kind of very high level of distrust amongst part of the Leave electorate and many Leave politicians in what they tend to refer to as the establishment. So there's a pretty substantial chunk of the British population that currently say that leaving with no deal at all is actually their preferred option because they don't think it's actually going to be very costly.
Well, but from day one, this whole Brexit exercise has been one of ideology butting up against reality. I mean, if you've had a country that's been paralyzed politically for a couple of years and is economically bleeding, why doesn't somebody wake up objectively and say, well, you know, maybe the problem is that we took this step in the first place?
Well, many people do. I mean, there's a very substantial Remain movement in the country now. They have a lot of support in Parliament too. There's a pretty decent chunk of the Labour Party that thinks that way, and that's one of the main sort of sources of pressure for a second referendum, because most of those, it has to be said, calling for a second referendum are not people who just think this is a good way to make the decision. They're people who think it's going to get the decision reversed. It tends to be an option backed most heavily by strong Remainers. The problem is that view is itself an expression of what is now very deep polarisation in British society over the meaning of the vote that we had a couple of years ago. There are some people who regard the whole thing as a mistake. There are other people who regard it as the most important expression of popular will that Britain has seen for a generation, and indeed the only time they've ever been listened to by politicians. So both sides have become prone to seeing this issue in almost existential terms, as either the most important democratic mandate the country has ever seen or the biggest political blunder that the country has ever seen. And when views of what the vote even means are so incredibly polarised, you can see why it becomes very difficult to actually implement anything, because the implementation always involves a good deal of compromise and trade-off, and there's not much desire for compromise from either camp.
Well, we've had a similar exercise in populism here, right-wing populism, with the election of Donald Trump, and it's always been difficult for the opposition in this country, the Democrats, to frame their arguments in such a way as not to insult the people who voted for Trump, basically saying, you know, you're suckers. You voted for a total fraud who doesn't give a damn about you and only cares about himself and a few of his wealthy friends. That happens to be the objective reality, but it's not a very useful political exercise. So is there a way to deal with the legitimate grievances of the people in the UK that voted for Brexit? Because they do genuinely feel alienated by a ruling class, if you will, that has basically never had their interests at heart.
Uh, I mean, I'm cautiously optimistic that, you know, paths exist to de-escalate this process and re-engage, if not all such voters, then quite a lot of them. What one needs to focus on in things like that is to basically frame the issue not in terms of them being, you know, basically making bad decisions, because that makes it sort of personally offensive about them. You're suckers, you're fools, etc. is not a good line of argument to use. It's more to say that what's being delivered isn't what you voted for, so maybe it's time to rethink this whole idea. So you're not involving them in a game of blame or being sort of appearing to be dismissive of their motives or implying that they didn't really know what they were doing. So, you know, I think there are ways to make the argument in a constructive way, and I think there are a fair number of politicians who try to do that. But what we butt up against in this situation is a kind of vicious circle effect of the polarisation, which is the kind of people who make the arguments like that in a sort of more reasonable and nuanced and blame-free way. They tend to get drowned out by the much louder, identity-focused tribal voices who will scream bloody murder about betrayal on one side and scream bloody murder on the other side about Russian plots and idiot hicks voting for things they didn't understand and getting conned by an evil right-wing media and so on. So the problem is not that voices don't exist that will try and bring people together. The problem is once people are sort of torn in this way, all of the energy tends to flow to the most extreme voices in the conversation. They get all the attention, and that just reinforces the division. And at present, I don't see how we get out of that. The first step to getting out of that is to actually make some sort of a decision on this process. But saying this as someone who's having to live through all of this in Britain, I'm really not looking forward to the next couple of months, I can tell you.
Well, you know, what we've had here in the United States as a way to deal with America's moment of right-wing populism that's clearly backfired enormously, which is the election of Donald Trump. And the analogy would be with the UK's Brexit vote. Now, the kind of people that were associated with championing Brexit, who you wrote about, Rob Ford, in your book Revolt on the Right, are not exactly a Churchillian bunch, are they? I mean, and the fact that Aaron Banks, this rather shady figure, was able to finance it in part, where there's a great deal of suspicion that Russian money flowed through his Russian wife. There's never been an inquiry in the United Kingdom as there has been here in the United States. So much of the political opposition in this country is waiting on Robert Mueller to deliver what everybody thinks is really what happened here in terms of Russia's influence over our election of Donald Trump. There's no equivalent in the United Kingdom, is there, of an investigation into who was behind Brexit, how did it happen, and who are these people, and who does it benefit?
Well, I mean, there are a number of investigations sort of ongoing. There are sort of parliamentary investigations, there are various media investigations, but there's not really anything that has the kind of institutional status of what Mueller is doing. Although, does it make much difference? I'm not sure, because I think those who are hoping that Mueller's report will bring some sort of closure, you know, and that people will see the light about Trump's misdeeds, I don't really see that happening, to be perfectly honest. And similarly, even if we were to have a big investigation and it shows that, you know, laid bare the misdeeds of the Vote Leave campaign and so on, and showed that there was a bunch of shady stuff going on, which quite likely it would show, I don't think it would make any difference, really, because I don't think Leave voters would believe it for a minute, and even those who did would say, well, you know, the Chancellor of the Exchequer sent out big, you know, big brochures to every household in the country trying to scare the daylights out of them about the prospect of a recession if we voted to leave, and isn't that also a shady practice, number one? And number two, what it will do, which I think perpetuates this problem of polarisation, is that it'll encourage Remainers to think that the only thing that was going on with the Leave vote was that people were getting conned by shady people using Russian money, and basically ignoring the other sort of things that were driving people to vote in this particular way. And once again, you get that polarization where one side is dismissing the other side as essentially a bunch of people who are conned, and the other side are understandably not happy to basically be told that their votes don't really count for as much because they're regarded by the other side as being stupid. That framing hasn't worked for us. Mueller or investigations into Arron Banks just encourage that framing, and so we end up back in the same argument where, you know, it's like a really bad family Christmas where everyone's just shouting across each other and nobody's actually listening to what anybody's saying.
Right. Well, I can see, I think you're absolutely right, Rob Ford. But on the other hand, it's not, when you're looking around to try and understand what the hell has happened here, it does seem like an extraordinarily self-inflicted wound that has literally paralyzed this country. And you just said you don't even want to face the next few months. So this is not going away. So it does seem like if somebody wanted to screw with the United Kingdom, they sure found a hell of an effective way to do so. Without assigning blame, I'm just saying, it just seems like, objectively, this is a self-inflicted wound. So, you know, you could almost use the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm.
Well, I entirely agree. And I think once we get to the point where tempers have cooled just a little bit, that is something that needs to be looked at more systematically. But to do it properly, you need an answer to the question, who can we assign to do this that is sufficiently beyond reproach that all sides will trust them and actually listen to what they have to say when they report. Now, I think that in the US they did a very good job by tasking Mueller with this, because despite Trump's repeated efforts to sort of politicize him, he still enjoys, I think, a relatively high amount of trust across the political spectrum. Nobody, I think, has total cross-partisan trust in the US anymore. So I think you're absolutely right. For the health of British democracy, it will be very important to look at what happened with all of this and try and figure out what lessons can be learned from that. I guess my point was more that in the short run, in a sense, doing it right now would potentially backfire. It would be better to do it a little bit, because, you know, it's not going to change the decision at this point, and it's not going to do much to facilitate the process of getting out of the quagmire. It would be better to wait a little while and let the dust settle a little so that we can actually, you know, learn from that process and move forward. And I fear we wouldn't if we did it right now.
Well, Rob Ford, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it very much.
No problem. Thanks for calling.
And again, I've been speaking with Rob Ford, who's a professor of political science at the University of Manchester, whose research focuses on areas of public opinion, electoral choice, and party politics. And he's the author of Revolt on the Right, which examines the rise of the UK Independence Party, which championed the Brexit vote. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with an assessment of today's confirmation hearing of William Barr to be the next Attorney General.
London calling to the faraway towns, now war is declared and battle come down. London calling to the underworld, come out of the cupboard, you boys and girls. London calling, now don't look to us, phony Beatlemania has bitten the dust. London calling, see we ain't got no swing except for the rain.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Bill Yeomans, a professor of law at Columbia Law School, who previously taught constitutional law, civil rights, and legislation at American University's Washington College of Law. He also served for 26 years in the Department of Justice, where he litigated cases involving voting rights and discrimination in employment, housing, and education before assuming a series of management positions, including acting assistant attorney general. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill Yeomans.
It's good to be with you.
Well, thank you, Bill. And what did you make of today's hearings of William Barr to be the next Attorney General? To use a pun, the Barr has been lowered by the acting Attorney General, Whitaker, who nobody's particularly comfortable with, particularly the Democrats. And he sort of auditioned for the job by attacking Mueller on television, and that got Trump's attention. And there are some concerns that William Barr got Trump's attentions, even though he's vastly more qualified than Whitaker, having served as an attorney general for George H.W. Bush. He nevertheless did write this unsolicited 19-page memo that also appeared to have gotten Trump's attention, arguing that the special counsel, Robert Mueller, didn't have the authority to investigate a president for obstruction of justice.
Yes. So it's been an interesting day, to say the least. As you point out, William Barr has credentials that are very different from Matt Whitaker, the acting attorney general's. And one of the strongest arguments in support of Barr's confirmation, I think, is to get Whitaker out of office. I think he scares a lot of people. That said, as you point out, there are some curious facts about Barr's situation, not the least of which is that he did write this unsolicited 19-page memo, and it's 19 single-spaced pages with heavy legal citations, arguing that on the theory that he assumed Robert Mueller is following in investigating obstruction of justice, arguing that that theory is inappropriate and should not be relied upon and was no justification for an obstruction investigation. That is a controversial theory, to say the least. But it is quite strange that he would decide to sit down and at his keyboard and type out this 19-page memo. It emerged yesterday, actually last night, in a letter to the committee that he said that he had shared the memo not only with Rod Rosenstein and the head of the Office of Legal Counsel at the Department of Justice, who we knew he had sent it to initially, but he shared it with the president's legal team, as well as White House lawyers. And it seems that the only person he didn't share it with was Robert Mueller. You know, what this does is sort of take us a step further down the road of Barr almost appearing to be a member of the president's legal team, and in fact, you know, cooperating with them, giving them ideas on how to defend the case that Mueller is putting together. So it's a very, very strange thing, and I think that the committee has not made any progress in really figuring out anything more about how this came about, why he did it, who he might have had contact with before he did it, what follow-up there was. So that's hanging out there. On the other hand, I think, you know, the bottom line is the Republicans have 53 votes in the Senate if they stick together. And from today's hearing, it's hard to see where there is any break in their solidarity. So I think Democrats have focused on trying to get a series of commitments out of Barr, things that he will do if he is confirmed, and assuming that he will be confirmed. And of course, the strongest commitment that they would like is that he would recuse himself from the Mueller investigation. He has not made that commitment, and it seems clear that he will not. I think if he did, Trump might well withdraw his nomination. But what he has said is that he will consult the career ethics officials at the Department of Justice about recusal. But then when pressed, he said that he will not commit to follow their advice. And I think it seems pretty clear that he is going to make his own independent determination, and that determination will certainly be that he will not recuse himself. So the other area where Democrats have tried to press him is on how much of Mueller's report he'll make public. And he has committed to be as transparent as the law allows. And he has committed to follow the special counsel regulations that govern reporting to Congress. That, I think, doesn't give a whole lot of assurance. There are any number of legal impediments to making the reports public, and the committee really needs to explore how he intends to overcome those impediments if he really wants to be as transparent as possible. So, you know, the president's team has said that they will assert executive privilege over parts of the report that involve discussions between the president and his advisors. We don't know if Barr will support that assertion of executive privilege. There will be grand jury material in the report, which is traditionally secret. We don't know how Barr will deal with that. There will be classified information. that Mueller has collected. You know, we don't know how that will work out. The other thing is that the special counsel regulations are very light on the reporting requirements. He's required to report about instances where he disagreed with the special counsel and prevented the special counsel from going forward with an investigative or prosecutorial step. Beyond that, there really isn't an explicit reporting requirement. He can send whatever Mueller sends to him up to the Hill, but he has no obligation to do that. Mueller's report to him is in the regulations considered confidential. So I think that the Democrats haven't made much progress in getting a commitment for transparency. The other thing that they have completely failed to do is to try to get a commitment about having him transmit the evidence that Mueller collects to Congress if Congress wants to start an impeachment process. And that will be essential. And so if Mueller determines that, in his view, Trump has violated the law, it is of utmost importance that Congress get all of that information, all of the information upon which that determination is based. And that simply hasn't been discussed.
And again, I'm speaking with Bill Yeomans, who's a professor of law at Columbia Law School, who previously taught constitutional law, civil rights, and legislation at American University's Washington College of Law. He also served for 26 years in the Department of Justice, where he litigated cases involving voting rights and discrimination in employment, housing, and education, before assuming a series of management positions, including acting assistant attorney general. So there seems to be a kind of disconnect here, Bill, that I'm trying to get my head around. On the one hand, William Barr, he knows Mueller well. They worked together during the George H.W. Bush administration when Barr was the attorney general. Their wives, apparently, are best friends. And yet he wrote this 19-page unsolicited memo, which sort of had the same effect as Whitaker's in terms of being an audition, got the president's attention. The memo was shared, as you just pointed out, with Trump's lawyers. So is it possible that, you know, I don't want to be conspiratorial, but is he a deep stater conning Trump into believing he's one of them when in fact he's going to support Mueller? Or did he seek this job and the 19-page memo that he wrote, is that what he really believes? In which case, you know, we should be nervous.
Well, I don't think we know. I'm not ready to jump into a conspiracy theory. You know, he's insisted throughout this hearing that he doesn't need this job. He didn't go after this job. That's been his line. He says he's 68 years old. He's been winding down his legal career, and he was not eager to do this. But I think he argues that it was his sense of responsibility to the country that convinced him to do it. So I'm not sure that there's any grand conspiracy, although in the age in which we live, who knows? But I do think that we just don't have enough answers on the 19-page memo. I still find it baffling. This is no small undertaking. You know, William Barr is a lawyer at Kirkland & Ellis, where the hourly fees are enormous. And for him to sit down, and he says he wrote this memo himself, including checking his own citations. So that's an investment of a lot of hours. I mean, this memo is worth tens and tens and thousands of dollars worth of legal practice. And, you know, maybe he did it out of some sense of responsibility, but the memo is very curious because he starts off by saying he doesn't have the facts. And so why you would go out of your way to dispute a theory when you don't even know if that's a theory that Mueller is relying on, it seems that there has to be some ulterior motive.
Well, that's
and
the question.
I don't know what it is.
That is the question. Why did he write it in the first place? Because almost everything he said today in terms of giving assurances to Democratic senators was that, you know, he respects Mueller and he wants transparency. And he doesn't want the White House to be able to edit the report. He's not going to allow himself to be bullied by the White House. So, well, it's almost like everything he said today to the Democrats on the Judiciary Committee is the opposite of what he laid out in the memo. So would it be possible or likely, Bill, that when he gets into the Justice Department, back as Attorney General and Whitaker is gone, and he talks to Mueller, maybe once Mueller tells him what he's doing, do you think that might change things?
Well, who knows? You know, I mean, I think the thing about William Barr is we know a couple things. We know he's very conservative, politically very conservative, and he makes no bones about that. But we also know that he does have a strong interest in public service, and, you know, there has never been a whiff of controversy about his ethics or an issue of corruption or anything like that. And so it may well be that when he gets into the Department of Justice and he sees the evidence that he sits down with Rosenstein and Mueller and they start going through the case, that he will understand the importance of following through on this. And he has said that he thinks that it is in the public interest for Mueller to complete his investigation. So it's possible when he gets there, he will do that. Now, if he can maintain that in the face of what will undoubtedly be a furious endgame by the president, we'll see. And, you know, he did suggest that if he were ordered to do something that was unlawful, he would resign. It's not clear exactly what he thinks is unlawful. You know, he does adhere to this theory of presidential power that's quite broad, and he has in the past opined that the president has the power to close an investigation. So it's not clear that he would view the closing of the investigation as unlawful, although he did say that he thought it would be inconsistent with the president's obligation under the Constitution to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. So there are just a lot of unanswered questions about him. The problem is that we're just not going to get answers. The senators will now file a whole raft of questions for the record, questions that will be answered in writing. Those are, of course, easy to evade. And because the Senate Republicans seem to be in lockstep on the nomination, there won't be pressure on him to come forth with any more information.
So just to wrap it up here, Bill Yeomans, as you pointed out, the Mueller investigation goes to Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein because the original Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, recused himself. Barr said today and before the Senate Judiciary Committee that he would want Rosenstein to stay on for a little longer during the transition. So what are the steps? You mentioned them earlier. The steps are that the report goes to Rosenstein, and then it's up to Rosenstein to send it on to the Congress, right? Is that as far as the statute or the rules have stated it?
Yeah, well, there are the special counsel regulations that were adopted by the Department of Justice when the independent counsel law expired late in the Clinton administration. And so these regulations were written under Janet Reno, who was Clinton's attorney general. And the reporting requirements, the way it goes is that Mueller concludes his investigation. He does a report. He does all of his indictments, whatever. And he is required to submit a confidential, and the statute says it's a confidential report to the attorney general. In this case, it's the acting attorney general, Rod Rosenstein. If Barr is confirmed by the time he does this, then it will be directly to Barr. And explaining his decisions to prosecute, not prosecute, whatever. From there, it is entirely up to the Attorney General to decide whether or not anything goes to Congress, except there is one obligation, which is that he must report to Congress instances where he rejected something that the special counsel wanted to do. That seems to be pretty much the extent of the reporting requirement. He has to report that the investigation is concluded. Beyond that, the Attorney General can decide to write his own report. He can decide to pass along Mueller's confidential report, which, as I mentioned, might require some serious redactions for grand jury material and classified information. But we don't know what will happen. We don't have a commitment at this point. But then, as I said, there is the other part of this, which is, well, there are two other parts. One is that, you know, there's also, insofar as we know, a counterintelligence investigation going on that Mueller is probably conducting. How Congress gets briefed on that, we just don't really know. But that would obviously have to probably go through the Intelligence Committee, and certainly there would not be a public report of the counterintelligence investigation. The other thing is that if Mueller concludes that the president has committed crimes, then there needs to be a referral for impeachment. That mechanism is not really addressed by the special counsel regulations. There's also the activity in the Southern District of New York, where the president has already been identified as having committed crimes.
Right.
That material needs to go at some point to Congress for consideration for impeachment.
Well, Bill Yeomans, you've given us a lot to think about. Obviously, today's hearings were very inconclusive in regard to what you've just told us, but I think it would nevertheless be very, very hard for anybody, Bill Barr or even President Trump, to completely suppress the Mueller report. So I guess in closing, that's some good news, albeit somewhat qualified.
I agree. It would be difficult to suppress it entirely.
I thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
And again, I may speak with Bill Yeomans, who's professor of law at Columbia Law School, who previously taught constitutional law, civil rights, and legislation at American University's Washington College of Law. And he served for 26 years in the Department of Justice, where he litigated cases involving voting rights and discrimination in employment, housing, and education before assuming a series of management positions, including acting assistant attorney general. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into how life in Venezuela is becoming unbearable for the average Venezuelan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Virginia Lopez, a Caracas-based journalist who has covered Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian and Al Jazeera English. Welcome to Background Briefing, Virginia Lopez.
Thank you, Ian. How have you been?
I've been fine, Virginia. Obviously, I'm somewhat preoccupied, as everybody in journalism is in the United States, covering President Trump's daily reality TV stunts. So it does keep me busy, but it's not that I haven't been thinking about Venezuela and been meaning to catch up with you. We haven't spoken for a while. Obviously, its economy continues to go down the drain with hyperinflation, shortages of food and medicine. But the latest twist now is that President Trump is weighing whether or not he will recognize Venezuela's National Assembly President Juan Guaido as the legitimate president of Venezuela, given that Maduro was just sworn in last week for his second term. So will that have the same effect as Trump's earlier threat to use a military option against Venezuela, which entirely played into Maduro's hands? What will be the response to Trump's latest threat?
Well, it's quite different now because January 10, or the date of the inauguration, has been very much sort of a bit of a watershed moment. I think beforehand, these threats were deemed maybe empty, just maybe a way for the U.S. government or the opposition to leverage in a negotiation, which never occurred. But now that Maduro has sworn himself into the second term and the economy continues to deteriorate, and with so many countries sort of posing a united front and not recognizing Maduro, I think that the thought that the U.S. would impose sanctions or would fail to recognize Maduro are quite credible. I think you're seeing a very worried Maduro for the first time in a long time.
Well, it's one thing not to recognize Maduro, but another thing to recognize an opposition leader as a legitimate head. And Chile and Colombia have expressed support for the head of the National Assembly and the new far-right president in Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro. He's also recognized Guaido as Venezuela's interim president. So there is obviously a move underway. So let's talk about what's going to be happening with the street protests scheduled to start on January the 23rd.
Yes, the president of the National Assembly, who's a rather young legislator by the name of Juan Guaido, has asked people to mobilize on the January 23rd, which is a very emblematic date here because it was actually the date more than 50 years ago in which a previous dictator was ousted. So again, it's a very sort of emotional and symbolic date for Venezuelans. But what's interesting is that in the leadway to that, street march, which, you know, is I'm not sure whether it'll be very popular or not, but the assembly has managed to unite behind the idea of declaring Maduro an usurper. And this is actually a very powerful move because it means that basically Venezuela's assets overseas are frozen and Maduro is rendered, he's basically neutralized. He's got no power to execute. Alongside with this decree of basically rendering Maduro an usurper, they've also passed a law for amnesty. And that's basically directed at serving members in the military forces and the police forces, vowing to grant them amnesty if they proceed to basically abide by the current constitution. So, you know, it could be that in the coming days we see an incredible desertion of previous loyal military or security forces. That, I think, is going to be a crucial and a very sort of a significant moment. I'm not sure that it's going to happen. Again, this is a very repressive government, and people are afraid. But it would certainly signal that, you know, Maduro could be facing his last days in power. Again, he's been incredibly successful against, you know, all predictions remaining in power, but he does in the last couple of days he does seem to have to be increasingly under threat. Also, because the economy is in such a state of disarray, we're talking about the IMF has predicted that hyperinflation will reach or surpass 10 million%. You're talking about salaries evaporating overnight. So, you know, this is a very complicated economic situation.
And again, I'm speaking with Virginia Lopez, who's in Caracas, Venezuela, where she has covered Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian and Al Jazeera English. But just on Sunday, Juan Guaido, the young head of the National Assembly, was arrested by Venezuela's intelligence police, along with a couple of reporters, one of whom is from CNN Espanol. They were held and roughed up and then released. He was released. And now Maduro is trying to blame that on the intelligence people, rather like Mohammed bin Salman, who most people believe murdered the Washington Post journalist Khashoggi, is blaming his murder and dismemberment on subordinates in the intelligence service. So is Maduro worried about getting, you know, one of the reasons why Juan Guaido, this young man, has risen so fast to lead the National Assembly is that, quite simply, Maduro is jailed and forced into exile all of the other leaders, particularly of the Popular Will Party, including Guaido's mentor, Leopoldo López.
Yes, absolutely. Juan Guaido is very much, you know, López's mentee and one of the fresh faces in the Popular Will Party. And you're absolutely right. Like I said, you know, this government has been very repressive. López has been under house arrest for at least 2 years, and before that he was actually jailed. And countless others are either behind bars at the moment or have had to flee the country. But Juan Guaido has actually been very sort of wise beyond his years. Apparently what happened during his brief detention is that he managed to convince the intelligence officers that were holding him captive that that they would be granted amnesty. This all is according to an audio released by López, and apparently this has resonated amongst other members of the security forces. I think the idea of an amnesty law is something that would appeal to them. Again, you know, detaining the head of the National Assembly is incredibly controversial. It also points to the fact that if Maduro indeed gave the order, somebody inside is not, you know, willing to obey him this time around, because again, after the inauguration on January 10, he's looking increasingly illegitimate. During the ceremony, the swearing-in ceremony, there were probably three state leaders, Cuba, Nicaragua, and I want to say Nevis and St. Kitts, but in any case, it was a very low turnout for a president during their inauguration, and a very sort of symbolic gesture from on behalf of the international community.
So already my understanding is that there's been thousands of rank and file have deserted from the military, and you were saying earlier that it's likely to increase. Do we have any understanding of how shaky Maduro's hold over the military is? Because my understanding is that the Cubans and the Cuban intelligence service have pretty much infiltrated the ranks of the military and are basically keeping it loyal. So what's your understanding of whether or not Maduro could lose control of the military?
The most honest answer is that nobody here knows what goes on within the military. This was never the case before Chavez came into power. You know, the military were a very transparent force. But if anybody tells you that they know what's going on within the military, they're lying. It's hermetic. The Cubans do have a very tight grip of that institution, which probably explains why nobody really knows what goes on behind closed doors. Maduro has just spoken, has addressed the nation, and he was flanked by the higher echelons of the military. You know, whether they're going to turn around is completely uncertain. But it's also true that low ranks have been deserting. And I'm not necessarily saying that they've been deserting on political grounds. I think that you have to understand that the economic situation here is so dire that people are fainting because they haven't eaten in several days. People are losing weight. It's just, you know, it's a dire situation.
But you were talking earlier about SEBIN, the intelligence service, and how their officers were swayed by the head of the assembly, National Assembly, that they had arrested Juan Guaido, the very person that Donald Trump is thinking about recognizing as the head of state. And Brazil's already done so, and Chile and Colombia are also doing so. So it sounds like if you lose the intelligence service, you're in trouble.
Certainly. But again, this was the version of the events as given by Leopoldo López.
I see.
I don't, you know, it could be that it's true. I have no reason to disbelieve him. The truth is, and we know this for a fact, that Guaido was detained, and very briefly afterwards he was released. According to Guaido's account of the events, he wasn't handcuffed. They tried to do so, but then they backtracked. And the people that took him initially were wearing were masked, and they took their masks off, and you know, had a conversation about amnesty with Guaido. I don't know if this is the opposition trying to control, you know, the narrative of the events in an appeal to the wider security forces to desert or to, you know, break ranks. It could be, but as of today, that hasn't happened. What has happened is that there's an amnesty law that has been approved, and I think that we can expect to see some stirring within the ranks because, you know, again, this isn't just a political crisis. This is a very deep economic crisis with, you know, low-level soldiers not having enough to eat or seeing loved ones die because they couldn't find medicines. It's a general state of malaise or discontent throughout the country, and nobody escapes it.
Well, it does seem like the arrest of Juan Guaido has captured the public's attention, because in just one day, Guaido tripled his Twitter followers from 100,000 to 334,000. I hate to sound facile, but we live in this new age of social media, and unfortunately, these metrics actually count.
Oh, absolutely. And he's every time he's taken to the airwaves or he's issued a statement, he's come across as an incredibly eloquent and charismatic leader. You know, I think the fact that he's a fresh face, he's 35, he comes from a rather humble background is something that, you know, appeals to most people. Certainly, you know, there's a wide discontent or disillusionment with the opposition also. So the fact that you're getting a young man who's been very courageous in doing all this, because he's basically stood up to a government that can be very intimidating, is bound to restore some trust.
Well, just in the last few minutes, apparently the Trump administration previously weighed the options in terms of imposing stiffer sanctions against Venezuelan oil. And the reason that Trump didn't do it was he was told that it would lead to a 15 cents a gallon increase in the price of gas over a period of 6 months. But apparently they're reconsidering that. And also on top of that, as you mentioned earlier, if you declare Juan Guaido the head of state, basically he ends up with all of Venezuela's assets abroad. At least that is a mechanism by which the rest of the world can isolate Maduro.
Oh, absolutely. And under the current economic situation, it would be, like I said, it would just be atrocious for the Maduro government. We're talking with If those oil sanctions do go through, you're talking of more than one-third of Venezuela's current oil production just sliced off, you know, in one sweep. And as you know, Venezuela only produces oil at the moment. So, you know, losing one-third of your revenue when it's already very low, it's going to prove deadly.
Well, but very few countries can refine Venezuelan oil because it's very thick, heavy crude. But the Texas refineries are the few places that do it. So Citgo, which is the outlet for Venezuela, that would end up essentially in Juan Guaido's hands?
Yes, it could. It could. I'd like to think it would end up in the hands of the Venezuelan government. But certainly. I think that is more at stake here is the fact that under the Maduro government, there's been a move to basically either sell some of these assets, like the Citgo refinery, or to grant control of the oil fields to either small players or the Russian government. With the OFAC sanctions, which are already in place, this has been blocked. But again, if Maduro is seen as an usurping president, he wouldn't have any control whatsoever, and none of his actions would be legitimate. So any attempt to sell off oil fields and try and recover the economy would be useless. And again, you know, this might come down to the economy in the end.
Well, Virginia Lopez, I thank you for joining us, and I'll give you another call in about a week from now, on the 23rd, to see what's happening with these planned street demonstrations against this incredibly unpopular, incompetent, and corrupt government that you have that has ruined a country. I mean, the idea that you could ruin an oil-rich country and bankrupt it, you know, you have to be amazingly incompetent to do that.
It was the wealthiest nation in Latin America and the most stable democracy for so long. It's unfathomable. But yes, we might be speaking before then, but who knows?
Okay. Well, I thank you for joining us, Virginia.
Sure.
And again, I've been speaking with Virginia Lopez, who's a Caracas, Venezuela-based journalist who's covered Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian and Al Jazeera English. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
A lady dressed in white with a man she loved.